Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 32. On this episode, we talk Snowpiercer, a South Korean film by Jun Ho Bong. Unfortunately, it's taken over a year to get this film to America, thanks to, I guess, the Weinsteins. There was some dispute there, but we finally get it. Unfortunately, not with the fanfare it probably deserved. Even though it is a South Korean film, it did star Chris Evans and John Hurt, Ed Harris, and a slew of other American actors that, I mean, were just fantastic in this film. It's one of those sci-fi, post-apocalyptic, dystopian films that's like a throwback to some of the better sci-fi films in history that really ask great questions and don't spend a lot of time trying to give you the answer, but hope you can kind of come up with it on your own. It's about the fate of humanity. It's got questions about the human's right to even exist. So, you know, we're going to have plenty to talk about. Joining me is Elijah Lovejoy, who hasn't had a chance to join me in a long time, so it's really great to have him back, and mainstay of the show, Mark Wingerter. So we have a great show. It's been a long time since I've had these guys on together, and we just had a lot of fun. This is probably one of the best conversations we've ever had, a lot in part due to probably what we had to talk about. So I hope you enjoy it as much as we did. Here it is, episode 32, Snowpiercer and the Fate of Humanity. Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless. But it's just really difficult to see.
So, your job, Mikey, is a lot like body surfing. You just got to catch that wave just right. You ride it, and you're like, you're not getting crushed by it, and you're not missing the wave. It's a tough job you've got.
Well, Lucy won the weekend.
Yeah, so. And that's the thing.
Is she really?
Lucy won the weekend, but fundamentally, I have a problem with Lucy, seeing as how the premise is false.
Yeah.
I just don't like how she doesn't get along with Charlie Brown that well. It just kind of bugs me. Sorry, my cheesy humor.
But peanut humor.
Yep.
You had to bring it up.
From the Peanuts Gallery.
How
long can we make this?
but that's the thing, you know, when choosing films, like, it's not always about who wins the weekend. You know, we're not going to do Transformers. I had considered doing Transformers just because it was going to make like $1 billion.
Right.
But
see, you're proving yourself to be highbrow here. You're not just a money man. Like, you want some high culture.
Well, like I said, there is a non tangible, you know, rating system that things get.
Yeah.
Somewhere between worthy of talking about and making tons of cash. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's depth of conversation, you know, plus or minus cultural penetration.
Yeah.
And so those two things together usually, you know, come out to some number in my head that is not usually quantifiable. And, I mean, and lots of it is, who wants to go see it? Do I have people that I know who want to talk about this movie? That was another consideration with Transformers. I was like, I think that we could have a conversation about why people go see Transformers for an entire show that had actually very little to do with what happens in Transformers. You know, I think that would be a great conversation, but I would have had to have found two other people who were going to go see Transformers. And while people will inevitably, I knew people would inevitably see it, I didn't know people who were rushing out to see it that also were the kind of people who were wanting to have that kind of conversation.
Right.
So, you know, limited by my own resources.
Well, that's why Snowpiercer is a good episode to be talking about this on, because it is kind of that in between of what you're talking about. It's heavy, but it's also action. You know, it's some people are going to see it because it's gotten some publicity, but it's not really super popular, I don't think.
Yeah, well, not popular
in the U.S.
Yeah, no, yeah.
Because, I mean, and that's a marketing question and stuff, but, like I said, you do put it in that equation. I think it gives us tons to talk about.
Yeah. Well, it's almost like he shot himself in the foot, Harvey Weinstein. I was reading one of the links you sent.
Yeah.
Like, I just checked Rotten Tomatoes. It's in only, I think, 145 theaters across the country. Made $3.9 million, right under $4 million. So he pays all this money to buy the rights to this movie, and then he doesn't even let it come out.
Yeah.
He doesn't even hardly market it. So speaking of marketing,
I mean, the Weinsteins wanted to kind of, like, basically, they wanted to cut 20 minutes of the film and put a voiceover in it.
Right.
And, you know, Jun Ho Bong was just like, no.
Nope.
I'm not doing that at all. I don't care how much money you have and want to distribute and all that. I will never do that. And
which is weird because it was already hugely popular.
It was very popular.
It says a lot about what Weinstein thinks about American audiences.
Yeah, and it's he has a lot of power, which is really interesting.
Yeah.
And a lot of influence. But this was a 2013 movie. It took that long for them to to decide what they were going to do about it, and that's why it came out now.
And this is the hardest part because, like, there are movies that this happens to. Like, I wish I would have seen this last year because it would have made. I mean, for me personally, we're not totally talking about the movie yet, but this movie probably would have made like my top 14 of 2014, based on some of the other things that came out in 2014. I mean, 2013 or top 13 of 2013. Yeah, I forgot what year it was.
Yeah.
So, but
don't have a TARDIS yet.
That's right. I don't have a TARDIS.
It is still 2014.
Yet. See, yet.
Yeah, that's why I said yet.
And so, you know, I don't. Now, when I'm making a list, now I'm conflicted. You know, do I? Because I think there's another case. I saw Lone Survivor, which technically came out in 2013. I mean, like, it was one of those things that I'd mentioned in a conversation we had just a little while ago. You know, it got released technically like the very last day of, or, you know, very last week of 2013, but it really didn't get into even limited release in theaters until 2014.
I mean, speaking of Lone Survivor, my hypothesis or my working theory is that war movies put out by Hollywood are more transparently reflective of the political culture than any other kind of movie genre that gets put out. So we go to war in Iraq, 2003, tons of
war movies,
yippee happy war movies. The war turns south. Tons of these, like, so and so gets his legs blown off and is depressed for the rest of his life. Movies. Then things get a little bit more murky now, so you start getting these somewhat positive, somewhat negative, reflective Lone Survivor movies. So I thought Lone Survivor was a great movie, but it just makes me think. I don't know how many reviews or how many podcasts you've done on war movies, but it seems like they raise themes that other genres don't really raise.
No, that's why I'm really excited. Well, that's why me and the people who did Monuments Men were really excited. Clay Morgan joined me on that along with Laura. We were super excited to do that because I was like, one, I love war movies. Old war movies, cheesy war movies. You know, I remember when I was a kid, we'd have days off of school, like on Memorial Day or whatever, and I would sit at home watching like Operation TNT. I would just watch, you know, old war movies from the beginning of the day to the end of the day. I loved them. So I was so excited about this movie coming out, so excited about talking about it on the podcast, and it ended up kind of being a ho-hum movie. It
wasn't even really a war movie.
No, I mean, it wasn't really even a war movie, which is why I'm really, really excited for Fury later this year.
Yeah.
And this is why there's going to be like this log jam at the end of the year trying to get this podcast out, trying to talk about all the things that I think are really going to be solid movies at the end of the year, because I really want to talk about a good war movie. And, you know, there's always the chance that during slow times, which I think there's less and less slow times now because people are starting to take advantage of those in between, you know, September, October times now, that there's less and less slow times. There was a slow time last year. We got to talk about Serenity. That was awesome. But if there's another slow time, maybe we'll talk about Saving Private Ryan at some point. Because as good as that movie is, I think there's some really bad philosophy in it about, like, earning what you have and stuff like that. And I also think that you're really you strike a good point with the whole, there's a lot of reflection on kind of how society feels about certain things. You notice no matter how they feel, certain types of war movies make more money Because typically, war movies that make more money are the ones that are kind of rah-rah America. The ones that do not typically are the ones that, like, rah-rah, maybe not so much America.
Yeah.
I mean, Zero Dark Thirty was, I think, a really great movie, but it did not do exceptionally well.
Hurt Locker. Hurt Locker didn't do that well. I mean, Hurt Locker was one that came out, you know, like, in Oscar season, December. Right. Or at least in mass release, as much as it would be released, it was around Oscar season. It won Best Director, Best Film, and then it probably made more money because of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
but if it wasn't for that.
But I think also too, you know, war movies are a particular genre, especially when you're in a time of war, especially if it's not, you know, kind of like, not necessarily rah-rah America, but more rah-rah soldiers, you know, and kind of promoting just kind of that camaraderie versus looking at the stark reality of the war. People are not going to flock to see that because, again, you know, what are we... People go see Transformers, you know.
And well, did you...
they want to just kind of escape.
Did you see that one movie that Matt Damon was in? It was like The Green Zone or something like that?
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, wow, this is a really good movie. But it was basically like America is wrong and doing lots of very wrong things. Mm-hmm. And it got, like, trashed.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't... I didn't like it for political reasons. I just thought it was pretty well done. I was like, this is kind of
pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, like, it wasn't like, you know, movie of the year or anything. But
it wasn't great.
I wonder if actors have like their pro bono movies. Like, I'm going to do this movie. I know it's going to tank at the box office, but I've already made bajillions of dollars.
Oh, well, so I think lots of people do that to work with certain people. I think people do that to work with Joss Whedon most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that's how Much Ado About Nothing got made last year.
Yeah.
You know, a whole bunch of people being like, oh yeah, we'll come to your house and make this movie for 2 weeks.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, they're artists. They're not just, you know, working a job as an actor. So
yeah, I mean,
stuff like that.
Like I said, if you had a chance, if Martin Scorsese came to you and told you that, like, he really wanted you in his movie, but, like, you know, you wouldn't probably, well, it's probably a bad example, because if Martin Scorsese is going to make a movie, he's probably got enough money to pay everyone whatever he wants.
No, actually, Jonah Hill wanted to do Wolf of Wall Street so bad, and they were like, well, basically, you have to take the actor's minimum. And he was like, yes, okay, you pay me a dollar and I'll come to your movie.
Yeah.
Because he was just so, like, blown away that, you know, Jonah Hill would be asked to be in a Martin Scorsese movie. I mean, I think that was his whole attitude. I think he didn't make hardly any money, comparatively, you know, money, a lot of money for us. But
yeah.
You know, for an actor, especially for an actor with a name like Jonah Hill. Hmm.
Well, who's been known for comedy, and then he gets nominated for, well, I guess not second time he was nominated for an Oscar, because I believe he was also nominated for Moneyball.
Moneyball, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is really impressive to me for someone who's gone from comedy, not just comedy, but, like, I would say,
slapstick.
You know, like that slapstick, raunchy, typical, like, American comedy to that.
Well, you know.
No. But speaking of slapstick, raunchy comedy, we are here to talk about Snowpiercer.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the genre thing about, like, war movies, and I think war movies have more of a license to be politically out front with what they are saying and what they believe or what the filmmakers believe. But I think sci-fi has just as much of, if not more, of just a opportunity to speak about political things. It's forum. It's what I was looking for. Because, I mean, it's a little more veiled, but it's still very out front. It's just like you're dealing with it in a very foreign world.
Mm-hmm.
So. Well, I think the only difference is that I don't always believe that sci-fi technically is asking questions based on the current climate. I think they sometimes are asking questions based on
humanity,
patterns of humanity. Mm-hmm. Which is the only difference between what I'm hearing Elijah saying. I think war movies typically represent, like, something that's going on roughly around that time.
Right, which is what I mean by, like, they have a more of a license to be like, we're talking about the war in Afghanistan, how it's wrong. Like, I think sci-fi, yes, they're generally more talking about humanity in general or general terms, broad strokes, but they do have that forum to be able to talk about something very, you know, current in the climate.
Well, and I think that's what we were talking about, where we glanced at earlier in conversation, that, in my opinion, this movie, Snowpiercer, has a ton, or asks a ton of questions. And in my opinion, I think the best sci-fi always asks a lot of questions.
Yeah.
And the best part about sci-fi to me, or really good sci-fi, is it doesn't have to answer those questions. It just asks them and kind of pushes all the chips over to your side and says, what are you going to do about it? I mean, this is what we got when we... This is classic sci-fi. This is like Brazil. This is Metropolis, Soylent Green, like these classic movies that just were like, look what society could become. What do you think about that?
Right.
You know, they were never like, this is how you fix it. Like, they didn't have the hero that fixed the system. They didn't need anything like that. They just said, what are you going to do about it? So Snowpiercer, just for those of you out there, I hope you've already seen it if you're listening to this episode. But Snowpiercer is, like Mark mentioned, directed by Jun Ho Bong, a South Korean director. It's set in the future where a failed climate change experiment kills all life on the planet except for a lucky or unlucky few who boarded the Snowpiercer, a train that travels around the globe where a class system emerges. The cool thing about this is it's got a lot of really recognizable actors in it. Chris Evans, Captain America's in it.
Mm-hmm.
I would say technically his second movie of the year, but technically, like Mark pointed out also, it was technically a 2013 movie.
Yeah.
But it's got John Hurt. Some of you will recognize him as the real 10th Doctor? No, the 8th Doctor? 9th Doctor? The real 9th Doctor?
8th.
Is it 8th?
It's 8th. Christopher Eccleston is the 9th Doctor. John Hurt was the War Doctor, who was the second version of the Eighth Doctor.
Second version of the... Yeah, this
well,
is
technically, I guess he's technically the Ninth Doctor.
Yeah, he's technically the Ninth Doctor. Yeah, okay. So, anyway, Doctor Who nerd stuff aside, John Hurt's in it. Jamie Bell is a great. Ed Harris as the ominous Wilford. Octavia Spencer, Tilda Swinton, and then some actors that we will probably butcher the names of. Kang Ho Song. And another one I'm not going to try. So, you know, lots of fairly familiar people in this, and it's based on the French graphic novel. This is where I really butcher things. Les Transpersonnages.
Yeah.
There you go.
Very nice. Very
which I think is basically
think
like
the transportation.
Train. Yeah, something like that.
That's what it is.
But this is classic dystopian sci-fi. It, 94% on Rotten Tomatoes, so the critics are at least enjoying this. But I mean, I've talked to people who like it and dislike it. So what we'll do is something that we may have done once or twice on the show before. Actually, you know what? I want to stop for just a second because I just want to point out that Elijah's on the show, and it's been a long time since I've had you on the show, Elijah.
Should I take a bow to the microphone?
I mean, I'm just really, and this is also the first. I think the first one we've done almost completely in person, and not had anybody on Skype for a while.
Oh, okay.
So, Mark, Elijah, I'm glad you guys are here. We can see each other, so we can totally interrupt each other, and then give each other kind of parting faces. So, I'm really glad you guys are both here, especially to talk about this movie.
Mm-hmm.
So. Since it's been a long time since you've been here, Elijah, did you enjoy this movie?
I enjoyed the movie very much. Yeah, I love movies that make me think, and this movie definitely accomplished that.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's all?
It's deep. Yeah.
It's deep. Very, very well, deep. And I will say this, too. You know, like we typically say every episode, that we're going to talk spoilers because we're talking full, you know, thematic kind of narrative story themes. I'm going to put all those words out there. You know, we're gonna spoil the movie. We're going to talk about the end of the movie, the middle of the movie, the beginning, everything. So if you haven't seen it, you might want to see the movie before you see it. If you don't care, keep listening and then go back. And with regards to whatever we say on this podcast, keep that in mind when you do watch the movie. So I just don't want people to listen for the first time and not know that. So spoilers are open.
So let me elaborate a little bit more. I just want to say it made me think. So here's one of the things that really struck me about this movie as compared to other dystopian movies. And that is, how sincere all the characters were in their beliefs. And I'm contrasting that to a movie like Hunger Games where the bad guys, so to speak, they have one like pleasant conversation with the protagonist or the protagonist and their friends, and then behind the protagonist's back, I'm thinking Mr. Snow, whatever his name is on Hunger Games, he plots to undermine, and
he's like, nefarious.
Yeah, he's very nefarious. Like these bad guys, quote unquote. One reviewer said nobody comes off looking great in this movie, which is another interesting thing. But Tilda Swinton, her character is never plotting behind the back of Curtis or Gilliam or any of these people. Like, she is as sincerely as she can possibly be, mm-hmm. lecturing them on their turf in their car about mm-hmm. how good it is for them to be the shoe, the foot.
Yeah.
And it's almost comedy to watch it from an audience's perspective, because you're looking at it from the point of the underclass
yeah.
being lectured yeah. to. Like, I saw no nefarious, like, everything was sincere, as blatant and as jarring as it was always sincere. Mm-hmm. It was never underhanded.
Which is why I think, and I'm pretty sure we've said this on other episodes, mm-hmm. but the best villains are the people who don't think they're the bad guy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because they're the most engaging. They're the ones that you're trying to figure out. They're the ones that you can empathize with. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones that usually have to say something that make you really question why you root for the good guy.
Right.
And I think, you know, by the time the film is over, you know, we are
even more
that.
So the bad guy that thinks he's doing the right thing.
Yeah.
Right. He thinks he's saving humanity
yeah.
by what he's doing.
And I would, you know, this is 100% that thing. So,
yeah.
So, Mark, did you enjoy the film?
I have a little bit of a trouble answering this question, because I went back and forth for the few days after and up until now saw the film, because when I texted you right after I'd watched it, I was like, it's pretty bad. And the reason why I had that reaction, I think, is because I was very disappointed with the ending. There's a lot of, like, filmmaking blunders or errors, I thought, that just kind of fell flat, that I think kind of ruined it a little bit for me. But as I reflect and as I kind of look on what I like in films, and I'm a huge sci-fi fan, I've always mm-hmm. loved sci-fi, and this is a very good sci-fi world that they've built. It's a very good dystopian setup that they've built. It's got great visuals, it's got great performances, and it does ask a lot of really good questions, but necessary questions more so. So I like it in that sense. I don't like it as much as I think I'm hearing some people say that they mm-hmm. like it, just as a film as a whole. But overall, I enjoyed the experience of the movie, and I do like what it was trying to do, and I'm always going to root for that to be made as a film. Mm-hmm. This film is unique comparatively to other dystopian mm-hmm. Films, which I feel like we should. Should we define dystopian?
I mean, because dystopian, I had to look it up today. I didn't even know what dystopian.
Well,
was
in its essence, I mean, it's the anti-utopia. But right. like, mm-hmm. what that means in terms of a world and in terms of fiction is like a world where, you know, things have gone as wrong as they could in a system that should work, essentially. And mm-hmm. that's basically the dystopian of this film. It can kind of have other definitions. There was a really good article that you linked. It was actually on Christianity Today. Which I thought they put it really well, because this movie is kind of both dystopian and post-apocalyptic, mm-hmm. which they pointed out really well. Mm-hmm. And post-apocalyptic is like, the apocalypse has happened, the worst has happened, should humanity go on living? Should we be allowed to continue is the question that asks. And I think the other one is the dystopian, the question that it asks, or the preface that it puts out there is, this system is what has made this happen. Should it continue? And mm-hmm. who decides that and that kind of thing? So,
well, yeah, I mean, like I said, I had to look this up, and so dys comes from the Greek word bad or hard. So, and topos comes from is the Greek word for place. So, dystopia literally means hard place or bad mm-hmm. place, as opposed to utopia, which I think, like you said, is the opposite. So my question that I asked about dystopia was, what is the purpose of dystopia as a genre? So you could say the purpose of a romance is to give mm-hmm. you warm fuzzies and to make you fall in love. Mm-hmm. The purpose of a comedy is to make you laugh. Purpose of a war movie is to give you the rah-rahs. Like, what is the purpose
yeah.
from an audience perspective of a dystopia? And I guess I'll throw that out there as a question. I've wrestled with a little bit, but yeah. I've never asked that question before, so I kind of wanted to pose that to you guys.
Well, I really like dystopian, because this is the epitome of what I find incredibly amusing about Facebook arguments.
Hmm. Yeah.
There's a topic on Facebook, or there's a topic on social media, because it was recently in the news. I mean, this happens worldwide, but, you know, especially in America, where everyone wants to have an opinion, and everyone's opinion is 100% right. People throwing out opinions about how to fix everything, or fix this one thing, or fix society. Mm-hmm. and they never follow their method or what they think is going to happen to its logical conclusion. Mm-hmm. So the beautiful thing about dystopian, especially sci-fi, is that they say, okay, this system that you think will fix everything, let's take that system and show you what it looks like in the future and show you, like, does this work? Do you is this what you said works? Mm-hmm. And, you know, especially in this one, I think in Snowpiercer specifically, this holds a mirror up to basically how American society works and says, okay, you know, it's hard for you to see this because it's in this grand sprawling country that's part of this grand sprawling world.
Yeah.
And there's always exceptions, but if you put this on this microcosm of a train and really look at what happens on a day-to-day basis in the world, the way that you have it structured, does that work?
Well, let's not limit it to America.
I think I was going to ask what you thought was specifically American about it, because it's really about the class system.
Well, I think that's a really good. I was using America kind of as an example,
right?
But I do believe that it could be talking about, like, America's the front of the train, the rest of the world is the back of the train.
Okay.
But then it doesn't have to be country to country. It can just be, it can be about a city.
It's human nature. I mean, the director says at one point, this exists in South Korea, this exists in France.
It exists everywhere.
So this is a human nature question. I think a mirror is one of the words that came to my mind about dystopia. I wrote down, just thinking about this, I think one of the purposes of dystopia is to create moral outrage. So I want to put something in your face, and I want to rub your nose in it, and I want to see how you react to this.
Yeah.
I think it's one of the purposes of dystopia.
Well, and that's what I was mentioning before. I think you can do dystopia well, and you can do it poorly. Just, I mean, you can do sci-fi well, and you can do it poorly, because we reviewed a movie that I think both of you guys were on. Did you both do Elysium?
Yeah, I did Elysium.
Did you do Elysium? Yeah, so both you guys came on for our last,
That's funny.
Well, and to help answer the first question that you posed, do I like the movie? I hated Elysium. I did not hate this movie.
This was much better than Elysium. Well, and that's the difference, because I think this movie, when you're talking about Elijah, when you're talking about rubbing your nose in it, I don't think this movie really, like, rubs the nose. It just says, you have to rub your nose in something, what's it going to be? Whereas Elysium says, this is a problem, and now I'm going to rub your nose in what I think the answer is. And that's what,
You're talking about heavy-handedness.
Yeah, very heavy-handed. Yeah. And it doesn't just ask a question, it tries to answer the question. But the ironic thing is, lots of times when you try to answer a sci-fi question or a broad society, humanity question, you basically end up doing the exact opposite of what you're trying to do, because the whole reason you have the question in the first place, I feel like I'm saying the same words over and over, hoping I'm not losing anybody. You know, you have it because you're like, someone said this is going to work, let me show you why it's not. You basically say, my system, my answer is going to be better, but if you take what they do and you just apply the same principles, you realize that they're no different.
Well, I think the question is, what is your nose being rubbed in? So I think Elysium rubs your nose in kind of this cookie-cutter problem and then this idealized solution of the computer bug that downloads at just the right time to save the day. So I think
that's... Healthcare for everybody.
Yeah, healthcare for everybody. So I think we resent easy solutions. I think what this movie rubs your nose in, and maybe rubs your nose in has a negative connotation, what this movie is ruthless about keeping in front of your face is the logic of the movie, the survival. I mean, it's the lecture. Like, the long monologues are the lectures about why the train is eternal and why it's essential and why it's divine and why you should revere the system. So there's your nose, quote unquote, gets rubbed in that. Like, you're not allowed to. There's no ambiguity about the holiness and the deity and the excellence of the train. And then the other thing I think your nose gets rubbed in, I've never seen a movie that plots its scenes on the movement from one train car to another train car. Like, the jarring shock from walking from bleak, black, no windows, bodies pulling out of little compartments into classical music playing, light pouring in the windows, beautiful colors. And so this step to the engine, I think, is another thing like, if you look at neighborhoods, the good neighborhood and the bad neighborhood, there's usually a buffer between them. Mm-hmm. Like, there's this little gray area in the middle where it's neighborhoods are getting a little bit worse. In the train car, there's no buffer. It's like wall, bad car, beautiful car. And so I think that's also, I would call, like, a your nose is being, like, you're not being allowed to think there's some gray area here. You just, you're either scum of the earth or you're living large and you've got whatever you could want food-wise and otherwise.
Well, let me ask you this question then, mm-hmm. or both of you this question. We're talking about mostly societal decisions, mm-hmm. Or humanity decisions, political, socioeconomic kind of things that this is really reflecting against.
Yeah.
So, being real-world theology, do you think this could also be a critique of a religion?
Well, there was a lot of talk about, you know, in this movie about the deity of the engine itself.
Even Wilford, isn't he?
He's kind of said that he's divine. God. But even...
He's definitely a savior.
And that's what I was going to say, is that essentially once you get to Wilford, Wilford is just kind of another guy, and he even says the deity is the engine, basically. I don't know if he says that exactly, but that... You know, everybody's kind of like, oh, Wilford's, you know, Wilford's divine, Wilford's this god, but Wilford concedes that the plan and the, you know, the engine itself, the physical engine, but the engine that they have conceived of, the plan that they have conceived of and devised to kind of keep humanity going is the divine entity. And so, yeah, I mean, religion is a system. Religion has a set of rules and set of guidelines and a set of certain performances that must be put on and that kind of thing. But it's inherent nature. That's what religion is.
So is religion the veil or the system that gets put into place just to keep people in line?
Yeah, I think this movie had a very negative view of religion. A very negative view. And the reason,
I don't think on purpose, though. I don't think it was set out to do that.
I do, and I'll tell you why. Right. I think
Specifically religion or of humanity and the things that it...
Of religion.
Okay.
And here's why. So it was obvious that everything that they were saying about the train was not true. They're now having to put kids in little compartments because the part that they used to use to make that part of the engine go no longer works, so a kid has to keep cranking the shaft. They're hitting snow bluffs and everybody's holding on because we're not sure if the eternal engine is going to fall off the tracks and die. And so so I see the myth that they keep on repeating that the engine is eternal, that it's going to go on forever. I mean, it's only been going 17 years and it's already falling apart. So that's not quite eternal. So I see the myth as these divinity, the deity of the engine, the Wilford, the glorification of Wilford as savior. I see it as a societal necessity to keep the masses placated and to tell a story that hides, like, they don't say we need your kid to keep our engine going so we don't all die. They say we need your kid because Wilford loves children. So they're telling these stories that are intended to hide things that are obviously not true about the religion or the myth that they're perpetuating. And then the indoctrination of the kids in the classroom, I mean, that was a huge clash of they're hearing this beautiful story about how Wilford saved civilization, and here's all the people that have experienced Wilford's oppression.
I think that kind of goes, you know, where do you draw the line between religion and just propaganda? You know, are they saying religion is propaganda? That's why I don't think, like, it was necessarily a filmmaking choice to point out religion more so than it was to point out the kind of human nature and system of a class system. And if anything, they're saying that the proper religion or the proper belief system should be humanism, because, you know, the heroes, quote unquote, are the people in the back trying to, you know, set things into a kind of a humanist mode versus being a religious mode where we have this perfect system that works, you have to follow it, and we're going to kill some people to do that.
But it's really broken. Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. Like, I think just like any other man-made system that requires propaganda or misdirection, false truths, kind of things like that. It could apply to religion, but I did not think it set out to specifically call out religion in that particular instance that you're describing. But I think it definitely, and the reason I asked the question is because I definitely think it applies to especially most people's perception of what religion is. Especially, you know, that's why most people say, oh, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious. Mm-hmm. I don't want all these rules. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't need your structure. I don't want the Catholic Church or this type of church because, you know, all these bad things happen. And you tell me it's all beautiful and wonderful and God loves us. Mm-hmm. You know, God loves children, but really, you know, you're doing bad things to children or you're taking people's money or, you know, you're taking the best they have and exploiting them. And so I think it can apply, but I don't think it was directly... Or in that particular case, it was directed. The only place that I did think that they might have been alluding to religion is something that I think you already mentioned, Elijah, when like Tilda Swinton's character came out there and she was like, oh, the beauty of a foot being a foot. Like, love the fact, you know, I mean, that's basically like lifted from scripture.
Body of Christ, yeah.
Yeah, that's the body of Christ. And, you know, oh, it's so cool that you're not the pastor. You're just here to give money. Just be cool with that because that's what God wants from you.
Yeah.
And I felt that of all things... Either it was completely coincidental or it was the only thing that I really saw in the movie that took a shot at religion specifically, any more specifically than anything else in the movie, which was taking a shot at human nature.
And I'll make a few other religious connections, not necessarily to argue one side or the other of this question, but things that I think amplify the religious connections in this movie specific to Christianity. So you have the train is called the Rickety Ark. This idea that Noah's Ark has brought salvation in the face of judgment was water. Now it's a snowstorm brought on by man. I think the end was a recapitulation of Adam and Eve.
Mm-hmm.
Two kids walking, male and female, walking off the Rickety Ark into the new melting creation that they're going to get to repopulate and reproduce, resupply.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, and then the question of salvation. I mean, salvation is a very, I think, explicit motif in this movie and the different perspectives on salvation. I think Gilliam enacts salvation by keeping his section of the train from eating each other. Mm-hmm. Then Wilford sees himself as enacting salvation by even allowing them to be on his rickety ark.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think he's heavy-handed. I don't think the director's overkill or heavy-handed about it. But I do think he's posing religious questions and even using religious imagery and language for how he tells a story.
Sure, I think it's kind of natural, too, because, I mean, like, you know, even in just looking at films, it's natural to do that because story is ultimately based on the meta-narrative, which is what we believe.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it kind of, and especially once you get to this particular type of setup of story, you know, where humanity is arguably in peril, no matter how it actually ends up looking to some of the characters in the story, but it is an interesting, you know, kind of way to look at it, because there was a lot of religious imagery with the ark and everything. And I mean, I don't, you know, the two coming out, so this is where I start to I keep wanting to like kind of talk about what I didn't like about the movie. And I just, the whole ending just, I mean, I don't want to go there yet.
Yeah, we'll talk about the ending.
We'll get about that. But yeah, I didn't think it was overly religious more than it was just trying to, you know, talk about class systems, which was what I thought was, you know, the really good questions that it was asking about, you know. It's kind of obvious, right? The whole movie, the whole setup. I mean, the idea of all humanity being on a train is kind of ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very cut and dry, black and white, what they're trying to say.
Yeah.
I mean, the class system is very obvious in this.
Well, and that's what I think this really reminds me of, some of the, like I said, the classic, the tentpole sci-fi movies that are asking questions like this, because they, like, you know, there's no way that they could ever work. They set up systems that are obviously kind of straw men to a certain degree, but they're based on people's arguments or people's trajectory of argument.
Mm-hmm.
And so this one just says, okay, this is what the argument is. Like, things are okay. Or this system works.
Mm-hmm.
So let's take that system and put it in this totally, obviously, you know, unrealistic setting. Like, I welcome the fact that it was an unrealistic setting.
Sure, yeah.
You know?
There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, because they're like I said, they're trying to ask questions, and they try to take out all this other, oh, well, what about these people over here? That's why I really enjoyed the movie, because I felt like, kind of, I think I like what Elijah alluded to earlier. This is the kind of dystopian movie that I think we'll never see from a series like Divergent or The Hunger Games.
Yeah,
you know, well, given because it's not young adult, obviously, but we're not looking for the hero that's going to come set things right.
Uh-huh. It's less simplistic. I mean, we like our superhero blockbuster movies simple, black and white. There's the nefarious bad guy plotting behind the scenes, or bad girl in the case of Divergent. And
right.
Then here's the obvious good guy. She's pretty. She's reflective. She's mm-hmm. fighting hard. She doesn't want to hurt anybody. And so, oh, I'm going to root for her. I think Snowpiercer, to its credit, doesn't give you the same cookie cutter characters.
No, it doesn't. Especially with once you learn the backstory of Curtis and, mm-hmm. and everything, and how things came to be, specifically on the train. Mm-hmm. And I think what also really serves this movie really well is the fact that it is also a post-apocalyptic. Not only is it dystopian, but it's mm-hmm. post-apocalyptic, mm-hmm. meaning that they have no choice but to be here. Versus like Hunger Games. You know, you kind of just stay in your class, but you can fight your way out, sort
yeah.
of. You know, it's not like the world is uninhabitable. You're just kind of stuck in a system, whereas this one, the claim is that the world is uninhabitable.
Well, that idea right there is probably the question that, the biggest question that I took away from this movie.
Mm-hmm.
It says, or it's phrased, and hopefully I won't butcher this too bad, but if this is the best humanity can do, does humanity deserve to still exist? Because, you know, you're saying in a post-apocalyptic, usually you have people hanging on, people trying to do good, or people, you know, you're not really examining the system, you're just examining, like, man versus nature, typically, at some point.
Mm-hmm.
But this one is basically saying, man's living, if you can call this living.
Mm-hmm.
And if this is the best man can do, does man... is this better than being extinct?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, did you lose your humanity at some point?
Well, and that's where I think the movie climaxes with the question, is it better to take a risk of getting off the rickety ark? Like, it'd be like the question in the biblical context, if Noah's sons hated the ark so much that they decided to jump off the boat and try to swim to wherever they could swim to. So I think it raises the question of, are the stories we're told to live by, if they get to be so oppressive, does there come a point where it's better to try to jump out of the narratives that we're told is your only option and try to find a new option, which is, I think, is
even if it seems very risky.
Even if it's like almost guaranteed death,
mm-hmm.
there's just 1% of hope, but your world has gotten so bad, or at least you've come to see it as so bad.
It's like, is trying and dying better than living
yeah.
and not trying? And
yeah.
just well, staying and being complacent about it.
Because when I look at what's going on the Snowpiercer, I see that as death.
Mm-hmm.
Well, no matter where you're at on the train, mm-hmm. that's the death of humanity.
Yeah.
Whether you're getting crapped on at the back, or where you're alone and pseudo-depressed at the front,
mm-hmm.
or you're ignorant in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's death in lots of different forms.
Yeah.
So, is 100% chance of death worse than, like, even... I mean, say less than 1% chance of hope. Because mm-hmm. to me, what it says is the 1% chance of hope is better than these things yeah. that have completely gone off the rails
right.
from humanity.
When you have, what is it, these 7 people that they keep going by each mm-hmm. year that tried to make it out, and there's some kind
yeah.
of backstory to this that they thought they could do it, and they obviously froze to death, so they're the object lesson that, see,
mm-hmm.
we were right, you should
mm-hmm.
never get off the train. But, yeah, here's what intrigues me. So this isn't just one train car equals one class, second train car equals another class. So that's pretty simplistic. What intrigues me is this intentional plot narrative of mixing up the cars and mixing up the classes to keep things interesting. So once you get closer to the end, and Wilfred is having this conversation with Curtis, like, yeah, we caused the revolution. Like, we wanted to whenever the population gets too high, yeah. we create a revolution.
It's very Matrix Reloaded.
Yeah, I was going to say,
yeah.
it's exactly Matrix
this Reloaded. This reminded me a lot of the Matrix.
Yeah, I mean, it's, and I think that also plays a little bit into the divine character, like this kind of providential yeah. hand mm-hmm. sending these little red notes to people. And what intrigued me about Curtis, at one point, he and Gilliam are, they're at a lull in the battle, and they're debating what to do next. And Gilliam makes the case, let's wait for another red note that'll give us direction. Kind of the, mm-hmm. nobody, it's not said what it is at that point. You find out later that there's intentional yeah. communication. But Curtis's response is, no, we're not waiting. We're charging ahead. So yeah. I think it's this, do you wait on Providence to guide you, or do you just go and kind of chart your own course? But I think that helps make the movie more than just a class movie. It actually makes it... kind of a societal upheaval movie, an intentional societal upheaval movie in some ways.
Well, I like that scene with Wilford, because when you talk about the Matrix, it was almost like Wilford and Curtis were like Morpheus and Neo, and he was basically saying, like, you know, do you want the red pill or the blue pill?
Yeah.
You know, it was just that basic, you know, the truth is hard.
Well, no, even more so in the much less popular Matrix Reloaded, when Neo is talking to the architect,
mm-hmm.
and the architect is like, all of your predecessors have not come this far,
but you're not the first.
Choice, but you're not the first, and rest assured you won't be the last, because, you know, we had this problem of an uneven system, and people were rebelling, and so we had to create this perfect system, and so that's exactly what, Wilford is saying in Snowpiercer. I see what you're saying, like, as far as class upheaval, This is part of why I keep coming back to, like, why I didn't like parts of the movie, is because, like, I didn't think it really delivered on a lot of that in the end. You know,
where do you think it fell short in delivering?
I mean, there's kind of a lot of things. Like, I understand Curtis and his sacrifice, and, you know, once the train crashes, evidently he dies. Evidently, conveniently, there's only two innocent people that walk out of the train. I thought that was super
that we see. I mean, we're assuming that there's two. It was a pretty bad wreck, so it would be a safe assumption.
It's a pretty bad wreck. It would be a safe assumption. We don't know, and that's a filmmaking problem. But I mean, like, you know, I thought Wilford kind of made things too easy and kind of started to spell out what the movie was kind of very visually trying to do. Remember the, like, when they were about to fight this, somebody called them an article I read, the stormtroopers.
Yeah.
You know, with the guys with the masks, like, wherever they came from. You know, so he just had all these fighters on this train, but, you know, so they take the fish out mm-hmm. and they gut the fish mm-hmm. and it's not really explained. And I thought that was, like, that is the weirdest visual I've ever seen. But once you get to the explanation of, like, we have this perfect ecosystem and the fish and there's all this imagery and everything, that makes a lot more sense. But then Wilford goes on to just kind of hand everything over very easily. And so, I don't know, I didn't like the way that things kind of, like, you know, and the Cronol guy that was real smart, I forget his character's name, but, like, he's the one that they said this whole thing about him learning.
You're talking about Namgung?
Yes, Namgung. Nam, they kept calling us.
Nam,
right?
Namgung.
And so they hold this whole, like, they put this whole story on him about how he learned about different types of ice and how to survive out there and everything. And it's like the train crashes and he's not one that gets out. I just thought that was, like, they set up a lot of things that they kind of just, like, let go in the end.
Well, he and Curtis, they sacrificed themselves in
but,
this.
But Nam did not really sacrifice himself.
But he was part of the bear hug that shielded the two kids from...
I understand that.
From death, so...
I understand that, but that, it just... That there was not real, like, a true sacrifice. Like, Curtis, like, broke his own arm off and, decided to crash the train and, like, he made a huge sacrifice. I felt Nam was kind of cheapened out, you know, they kind of cheated him a lot.
Well, there was this pivotal moment where he was going to take over the train, and he was going to become Wilford, and he was going to buy into... So that's...
And I thought that was kind of counter to what... I mean, like, I thought it was an interesting question, though. So that's why I'm saying, like, about this movie, and, like, you know, Griffin, one of our frequent contributors, was like, should I go see the movie? Should I... You know, I was like, yes, you should, even though, like, my immediate reaction was that I didn't like it. I do like it at this moment right now. But you need to make up your own mind about the questions that it asks. And so I thought that was a really important question in the end, was like, if Curtis really does want to save the people, is that the right way to save the people?
And that's what I thought was, in my opinion, the genius of the end of the movie. So the question at the end of the movie is, how is the director going to bring this movie to resolution? Mm-hmm. Is Curtis going to attack and kill Wilford and the good guys are going to win?
Take over the train.
Take over the train. The baby eaters aren't going to have to eat babies anymore. or is Wilford just going to, like, blow Curtis's mind with, here's what's really been, let me pull the curtain back. Now I've won you over to my side. Now you see why everything had to happen. Is that going to happen? Or is this, what turned out to be a third option, going to happen? We're going to blow the whole system up.
Which I think Wilford did not even see. Mm-hmm. Which is, I think, what I would have heard some criticism about is, like, why would Wilford make it sound so obvious what Curtis needed to do? I was like, I don't think it's... I think if you're Wilford, you're like, why would people choose to end their own life?
Right.
You know?
Right.
Like, this is humanity. You're basically, you know, you've loaded the gun, and you're pointing at humanity's head, and you're not going to pull the trigger. Mm-hmm. No matter how bad you think this system is, no matter how many kids I stuff down in the engine or this small compartment to pull out crap or whatever he's doing, you know, no matter how many people are eating locusts bars, you know, like, you're going to allow that to happen because the other option is the death of humanity,
which is kind of an uneven, you know, maybe that's his flaw, like, that's kind of an uneven belief, is that people care enough about themselves, like, people care enough about humanity that they're not going to kill it. But they care enough about humanity, so they should want to do something about the system because the system is killing humanity.
No, I thought this was the thing where the script understood humanity more than I think most people admit they do. Mm-hmm. I think at the end of the day, because I do it, you guys do it.
Yeah.
We, even if we don't want to, we're part of a system that we could do almost anything for anybody, especially where we are, being, you know, in our particular class, all three of us are white, middle-class men. Mm-hmm. Like, we have more resources and options than just about anybody in the world. Mm-hmm. And we choose to buy equipment, to record radio, to record podcasts, to talk about movies, to pay to see entertainment, when if we really wanted to change the world, if we really wanted to affect humanity, maybe we'd be doing something different. Now, I don't want to say that to disparage what we're doing, because I do think that we have, you know, there, it doesn't look the same for everybody, but I think most people would be Cypher in the Matrix, and they would say, well, ignorance is bliss.
Right.
Well, and they would always choose... You know, they would choose to be a part of the system as opposed to making themselves uncomfortable or putting themselves at risk.
Well, and here's a manifestation of that, I think. So Wilford is an engineer. He's a transportation mogul. He's designed this perfect engine. And so I think the engine, in many ways, is a microcosm of what he's trying to design on the train. Right. As an engineer.
Yeah.
So he's trying to design society as an engineer with precise times of rebellion, precise numbers of bullets, precise amounts of food, precise space for fish. I mean, all this stuff. Precise amounts of speed. And so in some ways, I'm just thinking out loud here, but I think the end of the movie almost has a little bit of an anarchist ending. Like, let's rebel against the hierarchy. Mm-hmm. Let's rebel against the engineered system, and let's just go into nothingness. Let's go into snow, into oblivion, and let's see what can come out of that. And I think Curtis is in some ways the hinge. So he's debating whether, do I stick with an engineered system designed by Wilford, or do I let the Asian guy, Nam, or whatever his name was, do I let him kind of pursue this vision of blowing the whole system up and kind of anarchy, loosely.
And at first he doesn't do it. I think the same thing that makes him try to stop Nam is the same thing that eventually makes him choose the thing. His speech at the end, he realizes, because I'm guessing that, well, we can only assume that Wilford, because he's engineering everything, he's saying math makes this work.
Right.
You know, we're engineering this perfect. Like, he can't see the depths of the darkness of humanity.
Doesn't care.
He
thinks it's necessary.
I don't think he's been able to have his perspective and or in my opinion, his heart changed
right.
by the depths of humanity. So,
why is he talking to Wilford every night on the? Or why is he talking to Gilliam every night on the phone? Do you think?
Because they both have chosen to keep the system going what has to happen for humanity. I think he's convinced Gilliam of that, and Gilliam understands that.
That was another problem I had, because I wasn't convinced that that was Gilliam's true nature, but Gilliam was dead, and they didn't really revisit it. Like, you know,
that's true.
They didn't really explore that. Like, did Gilliam have an overarching plan on top of it, so he was playing the system with Wilford? Mm-hmm. Or was he really, because they made him out to be a bad guy. Because they made him out to be the other Wilford.
Yeah.
Like, and so
there's a Wilford at both ends of the train.
Everything they built up about Gilliam, and especially in Curtis's story about Gilliam, did not portray that as that's what Gilliam would have done.
It's trying to make you sympathetic to totalitarianism in some ways. Like, Gilliam's a sympathetic character, and then you find out he's complicit in social engineering and this architecture of the train, of kind of a brutal architecture of the train.
But still, Gilliam's choosing, even, like I said, this is why I think it's almost brilliant, or it's a very good introspective inspection of human nature, because I think that Gilliam's like, someone's got to be back here, or I would rather be in the back of the train with no arm or no leg, whichever one it was, than...
Than
dead. And I think most people choose that. When you think that the only thing in life is life, like there's nothing that comes after, you know, there's nothing that was there before, there's only your life, you will do anything. I think most people will choose, on the whole, you know, it's obviously there's different things.
Right.
And I think hopefully we would say that we believe something different. But I think the person who doesn't have a worldview with windows that, like, look out on an eternity would say, this is all I've got, I will do anything to cling to it.
Yeah, I think what the Gilliam story at the end that Curtis tells, I can't remember who he's telling it to. I think he's maybe telling it to Wilford.
He's telling it to Nam.
To Nam.
Is it about the baby?
Yeah, about Gilliam cutting off his arm to stop the men on the back of the train from eating a baby or from eating a woman?
From eating the baby.
Yeah, they killed the woman to get to the baby.
Okay.
So they killed the woman to get to the baby. The baby was Edgar.
Yeah.
Yeah, Edgar, you know? who protected Gilliam. But that story, I think, really presented Gilliam as almost a Christ figure, like a self-sacrifice, a man who self-sacrifices to actually improve the quality of life on the back of the train, so that it's no longer... He destroyed cannibalism. Gilliam destroyed cannibalism with his self-sacrificial act of cutting off his own arm to feed his people. And so in that sense, and Curtis even says at one point, I'm sorry that I have both arms. Like, I feel ashamed that I have both arms. And so him putting his arm down to save the child at the end and losing the arm is actually an act of redemption, because he's doing what Gilliam did for his people.
Right.
So I think... In that sense, it's presenting, like, I think that's probably the biggest boomerang kind of shift of expectations in the movie is Gilliam, the one who saved his people, also being kind of a liaison with Wilford. Like, what to do with that, I think, is a very...
Well, which goes back to our original kind of point, you know, the best villains are the ones that... think they're saving everybody,
and
in this particular, you know, I think all of humanity is kind of the villain of itself. But we can talk about that too.
Yeah.
The thing that I just thought was really cool was the fact that there is this false assumption in Curtis that if he can make it to the front of the train, he can fix things. He's the one that can fix it. But the system is inherently flawed. Like, no matter who's at the front of the train, it's always going to be broken. And, like, there's so many things that, like, just jumped out to me about, like, this huge metaphor that this Snowpiercer was. And one of them was, you know, we all think that things will be different when I'm in charge. But you're still working within the same system, unless you completely throw away the system. There's also other things like, I'm not sure if it was in any of the articles, but I know we talked about it, that the only place... where there weren't windows, were the back of the train and the front of the train.
Right.
You know, the people who were the most misfortunate and the people who were making the decisions. So Wilford never saw the outside, so he could never be convinced that things were actually going to get better.
Hmm.
You know,
I think you're raising an interesting question about redemption. So when you say that it doesn't matter who's at the front of the train, things are always, in essence, going to get screwed up. They're always going to be bad. Nobody's going to be able to run the train right because it's a flawed and a failed system. It kind of makes me...
Well, the man-made system.
The man-made system, but really I'm applying your statement now more broadly just to life. Like, whoever's in charge of the organization, whoever's running the government, whoever's... pick the sphere of life that you want to pick. It doesn't... It's going to become flawed. It's going to become oppressive. It's going to become selfish.
Well, it's what we say about the church, right?
Right.
You know, like everyone's like, I'm going to go to church. I'm expecting to be perfect, but it's a whole bunch of imperfect people.
Right, yeah. If you find a perfect church, leave because you'll mess it up.
Yeah.
Or if you find, whatever the imagery there is. So the question that comes to my mind is what's the point?
That's exactly what I was about to get to is like, you know, this idea of perfection and, you know, Wilford is an engineer. So he designs things based on how they should work, how they should coexist, etc. And so that's kind of that's how we get to the whole movie. That's the whole reason behind the story. But, you know, they never really kind of got to why. Like, why that, what is, because there, you know, that question arises, like, you know, of even having a system, what's the point? Like, do we have to have a system? Can we live free of a system? And it's, you know, the answer would be, well, no. I mean, we have laws, we have rules, we have a society, we have an economy. But, you know, if you're going to destroy a system in the end, because that's the choice that Curtis ultimately makes, basically, you know, why? And they don't really get to the why this ecosystem type setup, why this kind of decision to destroy the plan. What's the new plan just to survive? I mean, you know, we don't get a lot of the survival in the end, but that's the good thing about this movie is it raises those questions. It's just that they kind of didn't do enough with them in the end, I didn't think. But it is that question remains of like, because perfection doesn't work, even though we think sometimes we think perfection will work.
Yeah, so interesting movie possible connection. Then I want to address your question because I think it's a great one. So I'm wondering, just thinking out loud here, if driving by the airplane, what is it, 7 years in a row, however many years it is, that Noam drives by there,
he says
it's melting a little bit more each time. I'm just wondering if there's a connection between the the dove or the raven in the ark and seeing the bird. The bird is what he's looking to tell him when it's ready to step out of the ark. But so
Fine. Here,
So here's the thing that I think... I'm going to go back to the Genesis narrative, which I think answers this question. So, how to put this shortly. So, essentially what God does in creation is he drives back darkness enough for life to survive. So, when water is covering the earth, it's impossible for life to live on the earth. And as Job says, as God says to Job in the book of Job, to Leviathan, the great waters, this far shall you come and no further. So God creates, there's water here that is seen as the deep, as darkness, as Leviathan dwells in the waters, and then there's land where you can survive. There's darkness here, which is going to have dominion over part of the day, and then here comes light, where you can live in the light. And so, implicitly, creation never guarantees perfection. It creates space for life.
Right.
And so we actually, so when you get to Revelation and it says there will be no more sea and there will be no more night, it's actually cosmological language for perfection. So we have sea now and we have night now, which in the ancient world were both seen as aspects of the abyss or aspects of darkness, which were always kept at bay by God's creative word, his creative command. So when the flood comes, it's God saying, I'm letting the abyss come back and destroy as a reflection of what sin has done to the world. So I think the answer to the question of what's the point of the ark is, or what's the point of life, really? For me, it is to be able to see the dry land, the light, to be able to live in the land, to be able to live in the light, and to some degree be able to see the light expand gradually until there is no more night, which happens at the return of Christ. But that would be my theological meditation on the purpose of life. And really, the inability for perfection now is not an inability for redemption. Like, I think redemption happens in the dry land that is the safe place to live while the waters are kept at bay and while the darkness is kept at bay.
This is why I want you to watch True Detective if you haven't seen it.
Did I just pull a True Detective?
Well, it's like that
sort of is the same kind of thing.
It's like the same concept.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which I want to say, but then I don't want to say because I want you to watch it.
Okay, don't spoil it for me.
You would love True Detective. Yeah. But
it's pretty dark.
Yeah, I feel like that point, like when, like if you're playing music and like a band plays before you and they're just really good, and you're like, crap, now I have to follow that. Thanks.
All right, so Mark's not got anything else to say.
No, yeah.
Well, I mean,
I think I was talking more. I probably didn't define like what I was talking. I was kind of like, what's the point of like what they're doing in the film? Like, what are they trying to say with it? But yeah, I mean, that, I agree with what you say in life in general. Like that's the theological, you know, explanation for what this movie sets up, and that's why this movie and dystopian films in general, kind of, you know, what we've all been talking about, is that they raise these questions that help us to you know, look at that in a light, and they don't necessarily answer it, which you said at the beginning. I was kind of like, oh yeah, I guess they don't necessarily have to answer it. Is it enough for them to not answer it at all, like in a film?
Or I think it can
in this
be.
Film,
yeah, okay. And I think it can be. It depends on how you ask the question, though.
Right.
Like, I think if you dishonestly ask the question, where you're basically giving the answer in the question, then I feel like you're cheating. You're trying to answer the question without actually honestly having the discussion. In this particular film, like, I know that you can take it in a lot of different ways.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I know, depending on how you see things or how you enjoy film or how you like your questions asked. I mean, this is why some people like certain pastors and some people don't like other pastors. Like, you go to church and unfortunately, most people want the pastor not only to tell them the question, but they also want them to tell them the answer, like the definitive answer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's great. Grace is amazing, but what do I do, you know, in this specific situation all the time, when lots of times it's a gray area? There's not a yes or no.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, some people really like pastors that are like, don't do this and do this and don't do this and do that, because it makes, you know, it answers the question. And some people are just like, that is a really great question. Let me wrestle with that, and let me wrestle with the Creator with that question. And I think this is really great because, I mean, as you've basically just kind of explained from Genesis to Revelation, you know, we get to wrestle with what's the meaning of life, and we have to answer that question based on our worldview. And our particular worldview points us to an engineer that is perfect.
Right.
And
I do think it relates to the movie in the sense that Wilford is trying to create a context for life. I think where he gets into trouble is he's trying to play God, but he's trying to say this is the only like my creation of life is it'd be like the abusive husband that just says, I'm going to create a perfect place for you, honey, where you're going to be taken care of and you can have no other friends, and you're going to be with me 24/7, and if you ever step out of line, I'll let you know how much you're endangering your life from my perfect universe. So,
but it's for your own good.
But it's for your own good. Yes.
Yeah.
So be the foot.
So in essence, we see from this movie that perfection cannot work in this life.
Absolutely.
No, we believe. But
that was the other point that I wanted to say. Like, we always talk about. That's why I don't really think we often see utopia movies. Because I think utopia movies,
we know they're so impossible. We know they're so wrong.
It's a
that's
lie.
A good point.
Like,
movie you mentioned, The Giver, is coming out, and it's a utopian society. And like, you know, that's all I know about the movie. That's the premise of the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you know, it's because I was looking up other dystopian films and kind of research for this, but like, that's one that's coming out. That's kind of, they call it a dystopian film, but it's based on a utopia.
Yeah,
which is intriguing. To your point, everybody who tries to make a utopian film is always really trying to make a dystopian film.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
They contrast the utopia.
Mm-hmm.
They show you the utopia to show you how quickly it becomes warped, basically.
And I mean, and honestly, the concept of utopia, I mean, then once again, this is a worldview-defining kind of position, but my really only problem with what we get, like, in one of my favorite sci-fis ever, Star Trek The Next Generation, one of Mark, I know Mark's sci-fi, is that they try to paint this picture of a utopian society. And I said, my only problem, I mean, more or less my only problem with Star Trek The Next Generation is that they're trying to convince me that humanity has wiped out greed and poverty and famine. Was, and I'm like, nope.
That was Gene Roddenberry's, you know, soul belief. I mean, it was not soul belief, but that was, you know, what he believed about the capabilities of humanity. That's the entire, one of the main entire bases for Star Trek was now we can go explore the
because we fixed
final
ourselves.
Frontier because now we can spread this message and not necessarily spread it, you know, because that was such an interesting thing. Like, you have this, like, Wilford, you know, engineer in this movie who is taking his message and saying, this is the only message. I'm spreading this to the entirety of humanity because the entirety of humanity is on this train. And so he has put the entirety of humanity, he's basically ruled the world. Whereas with Star Trek, they go and they have, you know, the difference with Star Trek is they have the rule. The
Prime Directive.
The Prime Directive, thank you. It's on the tip of my tongue. But the Prime Directive says you can't impose. You just can only observe. So that's interesting that, you know, that one utopia belief says, you know, it's utopia for us, but it's not for everybody else, whereas one says it is the only way.
Well, we are running pretty long on time, and I wanted to make sure I got to this because, as I try to remember to do, I asked for listener questions, listener feedback, and we did get one question from possibly our most brilliant, definitely our most beautiful contributor, Laura Fissel. Maybe y'all have heard of her.
Maybe.
She did ask, and we kind of touched on this already, so we don't necessarily have to spend a lot of time on it, but she asked, is Wilford really the villain? Is it just a matter of perspective?
Well, and that's, it's defined by what you describe as a villain. But it, you have to say so because you come in, you cannot, like, the film paints a picture of this dystopian or this utopia that is this utopia is a dystopia. It's saying that this cannot work. And it even, you know, the good thing that I think that they did, like I said, was gave Curtis the choice and said, could this work? And when you know ultimately the film is saying no. So in essence of the film itself, Wilford is the villain because he's trying to do the right thing and trying to save humanity, but his saving humanity is destroying humanity or giving this place of death. Yeah. So I think from a filmmaking standpoint, what they're trying to say, they're trying to paint him as the villain. I guess if you believe that utopian society can work, then he won't be a villain. But it is an interesting question because, like we're talking about with this utopia dystopia, can utopia work? Can this system work? Because essentially what he was doing was keeping humanity alive. It was a way to, but it was not.
So from his perspective,
he's definitely the not the villain. Yeah.
Yeah, he's the hero.
It's the system that works, but yeah.
I think the turning point at the end of the movie is when Curtis is about to be won over to Wilford's side. So Curtis is wrestling with the question, is Wilford the villain? He comes to the conclusion, no, he's about to take charge of the train. Then Nam's daughter runs in, pulls up the hatch, and shows Curtis the little kidnapped kid down there turning the crank to keep the train going. And that's when Curtis turns. It's like, you stole my friend's daughter to work in to put him in a little engine box just to keep this train going. So I think, I mean, you could say he's doing that for the good of humanity, but I think it's Wilford's dishonesty that makes him the villain. The lies that he has to perpetuate and tell, I think, makes him disingenuous and distrustful. The fact that he tries to make it noble when in reality he's just fighting for his own survival.
It's interesting that we didn't just explicitly say he kills people, so he's bad. You know, that's like,
yeah.
I mean, is he a villain? How would you define, like, if you ask, like, like a kid, like a 5-year-old or something, how would you define a villain? Yeah. How would the bad guy? What would a bad guy do? One of the things would probably say kill people. You know, he's a murderer
or hurt people. It depends on the age of the kid.
Kidnapped.
Yeah, I don't know if a 5-year-old would be like, well, he shot some dude in the head. You know.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I think if you boil it down to kind of basics, which is, you know, kids have that innate ability to do. He is a bad guy by definition of, like, he kills people. But then you look at Curtis, and Curtis was killing people. Mm-hmm. You know, he was a cannibal because he had to do that to survive. And so Wilford is, you know, rightly so, a kind of a mirror of that, to say that this is... Wilford's basically, instead of being a cannibal, he's just killing people off to keep the ecosystem going.
But he's justifying it, and Curtis says at one point, I hate about myself that I can taste... I know what a baby tastes like. Like, right. I hate... So... Curtis essentially repents in his confession to
Wilford.
Wilford does not. He justifies himself to the end. Hmm. So I think that's what makes him a villain.
Repentance defines good guy versus villain.
Yeah.
Well, I'd say, because furthermore, I think that's what defines people who I would say have a relationship with Christ and people who don't. Mm-hmm. You know, because lots of people we struggle right now in cultural Christianity. Mm-hmm. You know, people are Christian because they grew up in a Christian culture. Mm-hmm. But you often don't see, you know, redemption worked out in their life on a daily basis. You know, they're not working out their repentance. Mm-hmm. And
you do, but not often.
Not often. Yeah. Or
it's not a defining characteristic of a lot of people.
So
Christian.
So I hope that hopefully answers the question. So and we'll run through these pretty quickly too. We always get to our come on moment. So, Elijah, what was your biggest moment?
Pulling a machine gun out of an Easter egg basket, an Easter egg cart. Gifts from Williford. Here's a machine gun bullet to the head. Beautiful music in the background. That would be my come on moment.
Okay.
I have two. Like I said, I wasn't overly fond of several things in the movie. I couldn't believe how unbelievably corny the "I know what babies taste like" line was. It was unbelievably corny.
Really?
Yes. And the thing I hate about myself is, like, and the worst thing is, I know what babies taste like. And
no,
I know
babies taste better.
Oh, I know baby tastes better. And I was like, that, it just took me out, like, immediately from what he was saying. I thought it could have been much better written. Anyway, the bad guy that was, like, kicking everybody's butt, Franco the Elder is his character name, but, like, he came back conveniently at the end of the movie after he was... out of all the... Like, that was a really great fight scene because it was ruthless in what was happening. Like, it wasn't like all of a sudden Octavia Spencer is, like, able to just beat up some guy, you know, because she's the good guy. Quote unquote, you know, he just kind of turns around and overpowers her and kills her.
Yeah.
You know, same thing with the guy that was, like, really kind of wiry, whatever his name, Gray, you know, and he's a really good fighter, but ultimately, I also hated that they did the Steven Spielberg Saving Private Ryan thing with the slow dagger to the heart. I was like, as soon as they were saying it, I was like, don't do the Steven Spielberg thing, don't do it. Oh, but it was a really good fight nonetheless, and I thought at the end of that, he needed to die. Like, because, like, somebody needed to get him. And you kind of felt like somebody was, because he's, like, kind of the midway boss.
He's the mini-boss.
He's the mini-boss, yeah. So, like, I felt he needed to die, and then when he got back up, I was like, you just undid your whole fight. Like, I just thought you what you earned, his death that you earned, you just undid for convenience, and it really bothered me.
And when I thought about the things that I didn't like about this film, even though there were so many things I did, that was really the thing that bothered me the most. That henchman basically getting back up and kind of, I think it lessened the impact of that entire encounter by him getting back. And, I mean, and like, I understood the concept of needing someone to be coming from the back of the train. So you had, you know, it was on both sides. Like they were having to make a decision. They had to make it quick because it was coming from the back and it was in the front.
Yeah.
But like when he took time to like shoot at Curtis around that curve,
yeah,
I was like, conceptually I'm okay with this, but like, I mean, people who have never Curtis, who's never really fired guns and I'm guessing forever, and people just shooting each other, it lasted so long.
There's a lot of convenience in this movie,
and you know, the henchman gets to the front so quickly.
Yeah.
It really it really lessened the experience of going car to car and every car being like a like an obstacle. Yeah. When he just like gets up and kind of chases after Chris. And so that his entire, you know, extra life, the henchman's extra life, almost everything that he does kind of was not my thing. But
there's a lot of convenience in this movie, which is its most glaring issue, because it's like, oh, they just happen to have this, and oh, that just happened to be. I mean, I could go on and on with with a long list of those things.
And I think there's a lot of conveniences, but at the same time, the conveniences, for the most part, didn't bother me because we also have, the whole concept is a convenience.
Yeah.
It's humanity on a train.
Providential
overseer. So they're not trying to be like, this is where we got eggs from. You know, they're just, you know.
It's like, there's eggs. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. So, I agree with that. I think. Filmmaking wise, I don't know.
So favorite moments, Elijah?
Have to be Tilda Swinton. Very amazing acting, sympathetic acting. Like, you wanted to believe what she was believing, and when she was lying, you didn't think she was lying. She was so believable as a character that you hated her because she was acting so well. I mean, she was doing her job and getting you to hate her.
Okay.
So, I loved her.
Yeah, I really love Tilda Swinton. There's a lot of good performances. There's a lot of, like, good overarching things. Like, it wasn't one specific thing that I really liked. I really liked the tone of the dystopia and how it was bright and how it was, like, you spend so much time in the back of the train for the first part of the movie. Like, the first third of the movie is this gritty, you don't want to be here. And then they open you up to this, like, you know, classroom and this aquarium with a sushi bar. And it's all kind of weird, which is great about, you know, sci-fi. Sci-fi can be very weird. And I thought it had this nice, weird vibe to it. Strange, kind of off-putting, but yet so comforting. And I thought that the visuals of this film really helped drive its point home. So it is kind of a preposterous concept, but the concept is really great because it allows for a very specific, accentuated look at a class system, and it almost makes you start rooting for the train, you know. So I thought that was really good. A lot of overarching things. Tilda Swinton was the best part of the movie, but a lot of great performances nonetheless. And so
I would say typically when you watch a movie, and this is, I think, very prevalent in summer movies, summer blockbusters, like, the movie has, like, art direction. And that art direction gives you, like, they have a color palette, and they use, like, that one thing through the whole movie, and, you know, the movie has a feel. So no matter what happens in the movie, whether it's sad or happy, it always has, a feel to it. Through the cinematography, just through the dialogue and stuff. And I love that this movie, though there are some similarities that are strung throughout it, like Mark's kind of talking about, or at least what I think Mark's talking about, like, you go from car to car, it's like,
it's stark contrast.
It's drastic.
Yeah.
It's not like, oh, it's still kind of these colors. It's like, we're using completely different colors. We're telling a different story. And not quite every car, but like every section of the train that they're going to, you know, and it looks really different. And the fact that, like, they stay in their costumes through the whole thing, you know, it shows, like, you have a dude that's in, like, these rags sitting at a sushi bar that's, like, colorful and beautiful and clean, you know, and it does a whole lot visually that I think helps tell the story that you couldn't do in a movie if you weren't giving the premise being something ridiculous to begin with. So
yeah, and Curtis and Cruz standing in that classroom, like, hearing the propaganda was just, like, really jarring in a really cool way.
And for someone who had to watch Chris Evans in the original Fantastic Four movies, Well, I mean, because they were supposed to be good, but they were not.
Yeah,
and seeing him be Captain America, and really loving him as Captain America, being like, well, I guess he's Captain America now. But seeing him in this movie, and
he was really good.
I was like, wow. You know, you've come a long way since you were the Human Torch. You know, I mean, and there were parts of it where he was kind of like the let's go get him, you know, but it wasn't too Captain America. And even though Mark didn't like it, I really loved his final speech. I was like, I never imagined him being able to deliver that
totally
line.
I didn't totally dislike the speech. The idea of the speech was great. It just, that line, it hit me very wrong.
Well, I was saying, I think that really line corny. Would be really hard to get right, and I thought he did a great job with it.
It
worked for me.
I did, yeah.
It could have been way worse.
I have a very random question to kind of, as we're ending out. Remember when they had captured Mason, which is Tilda Swinton's character, and she was like, I can get you to the front of the train. And they're like, you know, they have this back and forth debate, and it's kind of like, what'll it be? And she takes out her teeth and says, Curtis? And then, like, it goes to the next scene or whatever. Why did she take out her teeth? It's been bothering the crap out of me. I have no idea. It was supposed to, like, it had to have meant something. Hmm. Any idea, like... I mean, you could theorize on it all. All
right, so
all
if you're listening to this and you know why Tilda Swinton took out her teeth,
please tweet me at Mark Wiedinger.
Yeah, on Twitter. you can let Mark know. You can let the show know, or you can comment.
That's right.
At once the post is up. I did want to give a chance for any final thoughts before we kind of wind down.
I just say again, great movie raises. I love movies that raise profound questions. I think Noah did that. I think this movie does that. I mean, those would be probably my top two movies that are like, wow, that movie is going deep and where it's taking the audience. It's not trying to be cookie cutter, or superficial, mm-hmm. or blockbustery. It's just trying to do some cool cinematic and philosophical stuff. So that would be, I'd definitely recommend it to somebody who wants to have a deep conversation like I feel like we've had tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think this movie is imperfect, but it is a really great concept that asks a lot of good questions, like we've been saying. I don't want to belabor the point, but that I like the fact that it left me not necessarily being okay with everything that went down and not necessarily saying that I liked it immediately. You know, I come out of a movie like Edge of Tomorrow, and I was just like, damn, I want to go see that again. That was awesome. You know, this one was like, I don't really know. It was so messy in places, but it just really asked a lot of good questions. So it's a movie to experience for you. If you're recommending this to somebody, because I cannot imagine you made it all the way through this episode without having seen the movie, but if you're recommending it to somebody, it's a good way to kind of say, it's something you have to experience for yourself, because it's a really cool experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I would say that not only do I agree with what you guys are saying, but furthermore, this... I think we were very lucky as an American audience, at least, because I enjoy this movie so much, there are two really good original sci-fi films that have already come out, or that have come out this summer, and I feel like we usually maybe get one, and lots of times we don't get any. And so between Edge of Tomorrow and this movie, even though this movie technically got released like in South Korea like last August,
right.
it, for American audiences, we have gotten to see two original sci-fi movies fun and original, and I hope they make enough money that we keep making them, even if they're not perfect, because this movie's not perfect.
Right.
You know, this isn't one of those movies that I give 5 stars to or anything like that, but I really enjoyed it. Like I said, for lots of the reasons. And I just wanted to kind of ask this question. Elijah, you might not be able to relate to this quite as much because I know your job is a little more organic, you know, in your time a lot of times. But Mark, that scene when they're fighting the bad guys about the midway through the train, since we're thinking of this and like being a part of the system, does that feel like going to your 8-to-5 job? Like when you're sitting there fighting people with hatchets and knives, that feels like going to work sometimes.
You know, there was a really interesting part in that fight where they stopped.
Yeah.
Because it was the 1 year. And so they were instantly just kind of like, we're all on this train together.
Yeah.
It's a really, you know, really interesting thing to throw in there, which I thought was a great filmmaking choice, was to say, let's stop this fight because it's the year anniversary coming around again.
Yeah, it's acknowledging.
And you just had those guys that were trying to kill each other just kind of sitting there together and like looking and kind of smiling together, and that was really interesting.
This goes back to war movies where they're sitting in, you know, foxholes across the line from each other and they're killing each other all day, but then at night
they stop
for Christmas and they're singing songs to each other or whatever.
Hmm.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate you guys being here, taking time to have this discussion, this really great discussion. I want people to be able to get a hold of you in some way or follow the things that you're doing. So, Elijah, how can people follow you, get in contact with you?
Just look me up on our church website. I'm the executive pastor at Church the Redeemer, redeemergso.org, and my contact information is on there.
Cool.
And if you listen to the show, you probably know what I'm going to say, but I'm on Twitter at Mark Wing Dinger, and I'm doing a lot of writing behind the scenes because I'm a screenwriter, but I am writing some on the Real World page. I've done some recent posts that I'm pretty proud of, and I've got some more coming out soon, so just check that out and tweet at me.
Tweet at you. I want to thank all the listeners who've made it this far. That's a pretty deep conversation.
Yeah.
Thanks for taking time to join us. If you want to keep this discussion going, if you want to answer Mark's question about Tilda Swinton's teeth.
Theories on why she took out her teeth.
That's right.
You can send me all the crazy theories you want, but like I legitimately have an actual reason like why she did that.
You can tweet at Mark. All their information will be in the show notes at realworldtheology.com. That's R-E-E-L, worldtheology.com. You can tweet the show at realworldtheo, or you can follow me at physification. You can get the show not only at the site, but you can get us at iTunes, you can get us at Stitcher. We've actually had a couple extra people rate the show. No one left actual comments, but I noticed that we've had a couple more ratings, a couple five-star ratings, so I really appreciate all you who have taken the time to go to iTunes and kind of bump our rankings. More people are finding the show. I've just been inundated with people asking questions about what we're doing next, what movies we're looking forward to later, what kind of conversations we're having, you know, how often we do this, can we do it more, and, you know, we're trying. There's only so many hours in the day in the system that we're caught in. But one thing that I did want to say, and I know I've mentioned it before, and I know I've put it out there through social media, but I really wanted to thank Chris Rosenberry and his web design company that he has, Fifth Story Interactive. He has redesigned and re-logoed, rebranded, basically, Real World Theology, and I think it looks amazing. We actually look like we legitimately know what we're doing.
Looks good.
And you can actually get around on the website now with a lot of ease. So if you need some, you know, web design or anything that way, if you like what Real World Theology looks like now, especially considering what it did look like for the first more or less year of its inception, then you can get a hold of him. And his contact information is, I believe, on the Real World Theology website. So thanks again to him. But as long as thanks are going out, again, thanks to my guests for being here. Thanks to you, the listeners, for taking time to make us part of your week. And until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is in no way mindless.
It's not.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
This podcast is a member of the Crossover Nexus. To find out more or to hear about other podcasts that engage faith and pop culture, please go to www.crossovernexus.com.